New World Witchery is possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors. We'd like to take a moment to recognize our producer-level Patreon supporters.
Heather, Wisdom Queen, Jenny Love from Broom, Book, and Candle,
Jennifer, Jen Rue of Rue and Hyssop, Little Wren,
Stephanie,
Christopher, Tanner, Fergus,
Akia Bronvensinak, Jonathan at the Modern Southern Polytheist, Catherine,
Peyton, Carol,
Stacy, Montine from Book of My Shadows, Victoria of the Distelfink Sipshaft of Reglova,
Wicked Sense Etsy Shop, Momasera at Conjured Cardea, Jody,
Athena Beth, Beau, Scarlet Pirate, Leslie,
Sherry, Jenna, Jess, and Laura.
To show your support and keep the show going, please consider visiting patreon.com/newworldwitchery and pledging $1 a month or whatever you can. And as always, thanks to all of our listeners.
Are you looking for magic? Maybe magic that lives right where you do?
If so, join us aboard our broomsticks and ride with us from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the Yukon to the Yucatan, and find magic that's right outside your front door or just off of Route 66.
Whether you're in the Windy City or the Crescent City, the city that never sleeps, or the city of brotherly love, we've got enchantment for you.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane, and this is New World Witchery.
Tonight we're talking with author and artist Via Hedera about her research and writing on folk magic in North America. We discuss old ways, social media, plants, magic, and art, and why diversity is so important in the study and practice of witchery in the New World.
Do you ever start reading something and immediately feel like the words are just for you? Like you've stumbled upon a secret trove of material that you thought no one else could possibly be as, well, frankly, nerdy about? That was my experience when I first bumped into Via Hedera's website. She writes about folk magic, a subject that is obviously close to our hearts here at New World Witchery. But she does so by bringing in closely read and cited sources of North American folk magic. On top of that, she's also bringing her own unique voice to the work of understanding that magic. She wants to see all the peoples of Turtle Island, an indigenous name for the North American continent that Via uses when discussing the magic found here, embracing the enchantment that has taken root and grown here over centuries or even millennia. If I'm honest, I was absolutely giddy when I booked this interview. Via Hedera's writing speaks to my sensibilities and demonstrates the kind of careful and thoughtful scholarship that makes my academic side clean and wipe its glasses, while also sparking more than enough deeply resonant magical fires to set my blood up to a sorcerous boil. So tonight, we'll be talking with Via about her work in folklore and folk magic, her use of art and plants and magical combinations, and the need for diversity and elevated voices from underrepresented groups in any discussion of witchcraft and folk life. I'm absolutely thrilled that I get to share this conversation with you. And so, without further ado, let's get to the interview. Our guest tonight is Via Hedera. Via Hedera has been writing blogs and articles and journal entries on her website, viahedera.com, for quite a while now, focusing very heavily on North American folk magic, particularly North American folk magic that she has been able to pull from a lot of really wonderful American folkloric sources. This has led her to put together a book, which should be coming out in late 2020 to early 2021, which will be called Folkloric American Witchcraft and the Multicultural Experience, A Crucible at the Crossroads. Via, we're really, really thrilled to have you on the show with us tonight. So welcome to New World Witchery.
absolutely thrilled to be here, and thank you for having me. Hello, everybody.
So I guess let's start. Let's, you know, think kind of superhero origin stories on this. Where did magic start for you? You know, where did you start studying and practicing magic, specifically folk magic?
So I come from an incredibly large, very diverse family, culturally, spiritually, economically, but definitely religiously. What was really interesting about all the many different sides of my families, which, you know, comprise of my native side of the family, my Samoan side of the family, Black side of the family, different, you know, branches of Caucasian side of family, is one of these unifying things I saw was that everyone had these little superstitions, these little fearful acts or these customs and taboos, these little rituals that they had in their lives, and they were completely normalized. And I never heard it referred to as magic. And as I got older, I started to realize that that's sort of what people were talking about in the Western world, these little things, these little moments in our lives, these practices we put together that bring us comfort and bring us together and express our cultural identities. This was so ingrained in me, I didn't realize that to outside families that might look a little strange, some of the rituals that go on in my household, or the fact that I grew up with tutelary deities in my home and very specific rules about how to address the dead. So growing up, folk magic itself, the magic of the folk people, of the common people, was super intrinsic to just my everyday life. I thought it was normal. Get to be a teenager, and I move into the public school system after spending a lot of time outside of that, and come to realize that that is absolutely not the normal for every person. They don't see that much magic in their lives. They don't think of these rituals and customs as having like deep spiritual or mystical value the way that my family did. And that really propelled me to research as much about how the whole world sees magic, how people perceive the spiritual world, the things that drive us to even want to make these practices happen, the fear, the grief, the need to cope, the need to hold on to traditions. And I find it really beautiful and connecting.
Mm, I mean, that is so in line with kind of what we do here too. So I love that. And it's interesting to me because like you're talking about, you know, these practices that are surrounding you as you're growing up. And I think a lot of people have these practices that surround them when they're growing up. And you're right, with your family, you had these deeper sort of spiritual connections with them. But I think it's really interesting how much folk magic people practice, even, you know, just thinking about the, you know, the 8-year-old on a playground, you know, flipping their pop top back and forth to find the first initial of the person they're going to fall in love with, right?
So absolutely.
Like, so I think that's fascinating to think like this is around us all the time. And, you know, we're talking about folk magic, and I think that can be a confusing thing. And I have an image in my head of kind of what I mean when I say folk magic. But what does it mean to you when you hear the word folk magic? Who are the folk, and what is folk magic?
I would say that folk magic, in my point of view, is the magic of the common people, the customs, taboos, superstitions, the mystical aspect of how the everyday person lives their lives. People have always seen the magic in the world around them, or at least they've tried to. We have so much fear surrounding the mysteries around us, and our ancestors were looking for answers. And when you go looking for answers, you will try all kinds of formulas and, you know, just algorithms to try and fix parts of your life that are hurting. And superstition and magic and all these different mystical unseen factors that play in our lives that create the customs and traditions of magic that we're deriving in folk magic, they come from just everyday aspects of people's lives trying to go forward. Things like writing rat letters to get rid of rats who are in the storage, or things like keeping silver and iron near the butter churn to get rid of witches. These were people's attempts at just trying to control this incredibly uncontrollable universe, this world around us. And I think folk magic is simply the ways of the common people as they try to figure out how to get that control. It's accessible. It connects people and transcends cultural and racial boundaries. It allows space for diversity. It's that common, low, everyday person magic. None of the high rituals, none of these extremely difficult rituals or ceremonies. It's what comes naturally. to the common people as they try to figure out what's going on in the world around them.
I love that. Yeah, that's it. And I want to come back to specifically this kind of like crossing cultures aspect of things. That's something that you deal with a lot in your writing, and I love that. But you also mentioned this idea of like, you know, keeping the silver near the butter churn to keep away the witches. And that's one of the really fascinating things. You know, both of us are kind of looking at this as potentially something that gets labeled witchcraft. And it's interesting to me because people are using magic to counter witchcraft. And then oftentimes people will be accused of witchcraft sometimes for doing some of those things which are supposed to be preventing witchcraft.
So, yes.
You know, to you, is there a difference between folk magic and witchcraft? I mean, how do you see, is there a line anywhere in there?
Absolutely. I think witchcraft is just a part of folk magic, just like healing can be a part of folk magic or spiritism can be a part of folk magic practices. Witchcraft is just one of the more shadowy ends of it. I think witchcraft practices differ from the rest of folk magic in that witchcraft operates solely for the benefit of the self. Whereas folk magic, you know, like other forms of magic, like cunning magic, tends to focus more on helping people. Folk magic has a lot to do with the protection of the community, of the domestic, the livestock, the family. A lot of it has to do with getting rid of the witches that malign the efforts of agrarian people, of the everyday person. And I think it's the blur between what is a witch and what is a magician and or a practitioner of magic is actually really, really blurry. The line there is not as strong as we think. I think in history, we see people of all kinds, Christians, priests, folk healers, shamans, everyone gets accused of witchcraft because in the point of view of the dominant religion, which would be Christianity, if your point of view is that anything magical comes from the devil, then anything magical belongs in the realm of witchcraft because witchcraft would be synonymous with the devil. So, you know, I think it's one of those cases where people, they'll go looking for negativity and they'll find it. Witchcraft isn't inherently negative, but witchcraft allows for the space to do things like hexing, cursing, negative aspects that may not be intrinsic to the rest of folk magic.
It kind of reminds me, there's a folklorist, Mormon folklorist named Eric Eliason, who talks about how a lot of times people talk about religion and superstition, and they'll say, you know, basically their perspective is, you know, what I do is religion, what you do is superstition. And that's kind of this dividing line. And that's kind of with witchcraft too, right? Like what I do is folk magic. It protects my household and my community. What you do is witchcraft because you're stealing my milk. And that doesn't always pay attention to the fact that like, if someone's stealing milk, it's because they don't have food or sustenance to sustain them. And that's part of the community obligation they should be.
Right.
So I think that's such a fascinating thing to think about, those perspectives. So,
oh, absolutely. I think there's reasoning and rationale behind a lot of the witchcraft that folklore that we see. I think there's a good rationale for it. There's some people are just reacting to the poverty or the oppression. A lot of it has to do with freedom from oppression or from repression. And I love that aspect. I think that's the best part of witchcraft is that it's pure freedom. It's flight.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, we're totally circling back to flight here at some point. So you mentioned the point about this is, you know, this cross-cultural experience of folk magic. And one of the things I love, you know, in your work, you oftentimes will refer to North America as Turtle Island, which is this indigenous terminology used to describe most of North America, right?
Yes.
And you do this really wonderful work of not only bringing in kind of these, you know, quite frankly, kind of older white men folklorists who've been writing about this stuff for forever, but also kind of elevating these perspectives from indigenous people or people of color. Why do you think that is so vital right now as we see this witchcraft revival? And then how are you differentiating between these kind of multicultural practices that incorporate all these different streams of folk magic and then the, you know, obviously much more problematic issue of cultural appropriation?
Ooh, there's a lot to impact there.
I know I really loaded that one up. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I will start at the beginning. So one of the prevalent tenets within my family of saying that gets passed around and gets passed on that's extremely seriously taken is words have power. Mm-hmm. So storytelling culture among indigenous cultures, especially in the coastal Salish region, is extremely important. These people are treasures. Storytelling, the ability to pass on information, to share wisdom that you've gathered, no matter where that comes from, is sacred. And how we use those words, the words we use, why we're using them, the terminology we use, the origin of that terminology has a lot of power and strength. Now, since my family is so heavily involved in social justice within the American Indian community, my mom specifically working for United Indians of All Tribes, I spent my childhood involved with the Hujezida curriculum program, and that has a lot to do with Native American justice and social justice and tribal rights. And one of the incredible aspects of being from a family that's so involved in Black and Native and Latino rights is being able to learn from these incredible figures of social justice from the 70s and 80s who brought about incredible change to the Seattle community, building things like Daybreak Star, Indian Community Center, the El Centro de Raza. I was raised by people who use terms like Turtle Island to differentiate between the America that, you know, the America that is colonial and white and assimilative, and the America that existed before that, Indigenous America, which are two entirely different places being occupied by entirely different people. So when I say Turtle Island, I'm trying to highlight that the time before the colonies deserve to be referenced as something different. It deserves to be honored for what it is. And the concept of Turtle Island kind of arose out of these social justice circles as a way to, for Native Americans to reclaim their identity of what America is, to erase whitewashing from the conversation. This isn't America for Indigenous people. For a lot of Indigenous people, this is a home. This is Turtle Island. This is the land of the Creator. And I think that deserves to have to be recognized. When it comes to things about multiculturalism and appropriation, that's where things get so complicated. And it's extra complicated because I'm mixed and I grew up very influenced by the white side of my family and the Black side and the Native side and the Mexican-American side. And that influence taught me that people all have their own view of the world, and it makes much more sense for us to find our similarities and celebrate those things than highlight our diversity. I mean, than to highlight our differences. We can celebrate our diversity without trying to find so much to see apart from each other. And that's sort of a struggle that I think we have in this conversation, is it can be really, really toxic. We want to express our spirituality openly, and we live in a very multicultural society. But because of the history of race in this country, it's extremely difficult to have that conversation. And that's sort of something I touch on in my book, is about how appropriation has negatively impacted modern day paganism, and what we can do, what everyone can do, especially people who are not people of color, what Americans can do to sort of honor those traditions without thieving from them, which is, you know, really appropriate. You know, it's really important that we get representation. It matters that we represent all spectrum of witchcraft, including from, you know, especially from a non-European perspective, which is what most of our stuff is coming from. We highlight that so much in our history. It's so Eurocentric. And that's not actually what witchcraft in America is. Witchcraft in America is a patchwork, a huge exchange of diversity. And we do ourselves a huge disservice when we try to stop the conversation. And so my book is, you know, I'm trying to help people, especially Americans, to have that conversation, which is very difficult. Lot to unpack there. Sorry, I could ramble on forever.
No, that's wonderful. And I think that there's a lot to unpack there. I think that that's, I mean, this is such an important part of the experience of folk magic, is that there is a lot of cultural exchange, but there have also been historical situations where there's imbalances of power and as you said, cultural thievery that happens because of that imbalance of power. So I really appreciate that you're addressing
Yeah, I wanted to make it clear in my writing that there is a big difference between inclusion and appropriation. Mm-hmm. There's also an element to American identity that has a lot to do with an experience. A lot of us grow up in environments that are very different from who we are. There's a lot of adoption. There's a lot of interracial relationships. There's a lot of dimensions to race in America where people are growing up in an environment influenced from a culture. By a culture that's completely different from how they perceive themselves. And that has a huge impact. And I want people to feel comfortable discussing that without trying to override that conversation or you know, appropriate from it. I think it's really important, though, that we do keep that open.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, I mean, the other side of that is we do see people who are obviously very much, you know, actively taking back some of this sort of culturally situated magical practice. So, for example, you have a really strong what I kind of think of as the hashtag Bruja movement on social media, like Instagram.
Yes.
And you know, why do you think that is so vital right now? Why, you know, why is turning back to this folk magic so powerful at this moment in time? Did I lose you? Hello?
I think now that we have the space and the freedom to actually say out loud and demand recognition, demand representation, I think people are really grabbing practices to their ancestry. I think a huge part of American identity is struggling. It's to figure out who you are. When you grow up in such a diverse society, it does present a lot of struggles about who am I? What is the guilt that I feel? What is my impact on this incredibly scary history that our country has? Now is the time for people to feel safe to do that. There's a lot of social media offers a lot of protection. And that's sort of what I really liked about coming out more and writing is that I'm offered a lot more protection as a pagan of color, as a witch of color, because I'm able to use the power of the hashtag. I'm able to rally people to understand my point of view. And that's really, I think, what people are trying to reach for. They're just trying to connect and be understood. And for better or for worse, it's the only way we're really going to learn about each other is by representing ourselves and being vocal.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. That's an excellent answer for that. So you were mentioning, for example, the idea of North America as Turtle Island and this sense of history and looking to history. And, you know, we've been talking about social media, which obviously is a much newer thing. But, you know, you like to work with a lot of historical folklore and sources sort of pulled from history. And I know that, you know, in some cases, those can be really, really problematic because they're coming out of spaces or times where, for example, slavery was an issue. So how do you decide what is usable, useful to you today? And how do you kind of look at certain pieces of folklore and decide, well, maybe that's better left in the past? Or do you have a process for that?
I do. I actually follow some criteria. The first criteria I follow is familiarity. I actually like to start with things that have a level of familiarity in my personal life or within my family or within my culture. So a lot of the things I post about are things that I'm familiar with already. And I was just sort of going down the rabbit hole, you know. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, does it have familiar applications in the folklore that I'm studying? Can I cross-reference this with older sources or multiple sources? Is there a cross-cultural connection that helps me understand better that this is coming from multiple places or where is this coming from? Is there a history to this practice as it appears in folklore? You know, things like one of my favorite charms that I write a lot about has to do with Halloween folk magic, mm-hmm. especially with fortune telling and stuff. And I grew up with a lot of divination, especially around these kinds of times. And so for me, that level of familiarity made me want to look back and understand everything having to do with where this possibly comes from. Why is this seen in both African American and Caucasian American folk magic practices? Why did those things parallel? And I do you know, there is a lot of problematic history. A lot of the resources that I go into, the language is so incredibly offensive in some of these old books. It's just the N-word flying everywhere. It's crazy. But I actually, I don't feel those same sort of sensitivities. I understand that people were existing in the time that they existed in, and that there's nothing I can really do to go back and change that. But what I can do is sort of take what I'm learning from these people and then try to understand the opposite, try to understand where it could possibly have come from. Mostly what I try to do is collect folklore where I can see it being practiced cross-culturally, where I can see that it's being taken up by multiple people from or multiple communities. And I like to work backwards from that kind of angles. Like, is this familiar to me? Why is this familiar? Why would this be useful? Is this folklore or fake lore? You know, so we have this history of witchcraft initiation that involves putting the devil, putting one hand on your head and one hand on the ground or on your foot and declaring everything between his. And that is so prevalent in our folk magic and folklore. Well, another bit of folklore that exists for that, for the initiation of witches, eating grasshoppers and crickets. But that exists in maybe like one or two sources, and I can't see why that would ever be important. So that's sort of something I like to dismiss. You know, a lot of it has to do with how popular is this? How impactful has this been on my culture as a whole? So that's sort of the criteria I'm following.
Gotcha. So yeah, really, it's that kind of cross-referenceability in some ways that makes
it.
Great, I love that. That's the nerdy library scholar in me to be like, yes, you cross-reference. That's fantastic.
I know, right?
Is there a footnote for it? Fantastic.
So. I know, right? And you know, I've worked for a college for 14 years. That has been my sole job since high school for these last 14 years. So I spend a lot of time in the library sciences department nerding out over this kind of stuff.
And that makes you a better person, I promise.
Thank you.
So kind of, you know, shifting gears a little bit, you're not only a fantastic writer and a fantastic researcher, you're also a fantastic artist, and you make some really gorgeous sculptures, particularly focused on these different sort of plant matron spirits. My favorites are kind of the cocoa and the coffee ones because
the cocoa and the coffee, those are your favorites.
I love those so much just because, you know, I like both of those things. Probably not good for me, but
I am so happy. So those are your favorites. I am so happy.
Yes, I love them. But it's really neat because when I see you portraying them, they're almost kind of. They remind me a lot of, for example, things that you see in like retablos and things like that in Mexican-American folk art portraying like Madonnas and things like that. And you really seem to see these plant spirits as very alive and inhabited by these particular entities. How does that vision come to you? How do you wind up seeing these kind of older spirits with sort of new eyes and envisioning them as these sort of sculpted entities?
You know, growing up in the Southwest had such a deep impact on me, especially the time I spent fostered in a family that was the matron of the family was a practitioner of Santeria. And one of the most important things that she passed on to my mother, my sister and I during our time with her was that there can be no practice without herbs. There can be no spirituality without these plants. These spirits that inhabit this world around us are vital, and they are here to work with us, and they can be placated, and they can be honored, and they can become your enemy or your friend. They are so incredibly important that no aspect of your life, you can't purify without it. You can't get married without it. You can't have funeral ceremonies without plants. They must be ever present. And so that was so ever present in my life. As I got older and started to work in sculpting, I was so inspired by the art of the Madonnas and of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is, you know, pretty much on the side of every gas station in East LA in the 90s. it was such a huge part of my childhood, just seeing this iconic artwork, this serene, meditative, beautiful woman. And, you know, beautiful women are great. Everybody loves a beautiful woman. And that's how I personify the spirit world and is in these serene, beautiful prayer-like women. And about 2012, during the height of sort of the popularity of the poisoner movement within witchcraft, you know, how popular that was at the time, hugely influential. I wanted to work on Hecate statues. I really wanted to express my love for the pharmakeia. And I started making these statues and doing commissions. And at one point, somebody said, hey, could you make me a statue of a woman? I'd like to have a statue of Salvia Divinorum. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, I have all of these plant seeds, all of these plant materia. I could try my hand at it. And I started to do a lot of trance work and started to see these visions of these beautiful plants personified as lovely, serene, healing women. And it started this huge cycle, this series of me making. First thing I made was a honey statue, a honey woman. I made a series of those, which I thought, you know, grows great with honey tea. So I made a tea statue and I thought, you know, I'm not really super big on tea. I love cocoa. So cocoa. And then I was like, ah, well, I'm a bit of a lush. So how about some wine? And there's a little bit of all of these plants in each of these women. The cocoa lady, she has a cacao bean in the center of her chest. The coffee woman has a coffee bean in the center of her chest. The poppy woman has poppy seeds running throughout her clay. It's really important that I imbued my spirit and my love for art and my belief that art is magic and is an expression of faith into this. And lo and behold, they became really popular. People were hitting me up for statues and I was kind of loving it.
Well, they're beautiful. I mean, they're so gorgeous. I mean, they really, if people haven't seen them, I want to include a link. They're linked on your website, I believe, right?
Yes, yes. There's okay, a whole gallery. You can see pretty much everything I've done. The Hecates, the Venificum statues, poppy, datura, tobacco, tea, lavender. I do a lot of work. I've done some commissions for Morgan Daimler. I love taking commissions, and I'd love to do one for you, honestly.
I may have to do that. Yes.
Yes. What would you want, though? What would be like your plant of choice, your food of choice?
Like I said, I love coffee and cocoa, just probably for all the wrong reasons on both of those. I weirdly have strong sort of family and ancestral connections to rosemary and rue.
A rosemary woman. Oh, I'd have so much fun with that.
This is a totally side. I may wind up getting all this, but this is a totally side thing. But I was at a craft fair one time and I bought this nice little piece of pottery from an artist who was there. And she happened to also be giving away little sprigs of rosemary, like fresh rosemary from her garden that were wrapped in a paper towel that she just gave you with every pot purchase. Well, I took them home and I did some rooting hormone on them and I planted them. And literally these sprigs, as big as a thumb, by the time I had to move, they had turned into a bush on the corner of the house where I was living that was about 4 feet tall and about 3 feet wide. So Rosemary and I get along great.
Oh, see, that would be so fun. I love challenging plants. Mm. You know, I've had people ask me for some really cool and interesting stuff. I think one of the most interesting things someone asked me for was to do a mezcal cactus woman.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I could see that for sure.
I like challenging stuff. One of the more challenging ones I had to do recently was lavender, which I did for Fawn Hex, the psychopomp groupie. Mm-hmm. That one, with all the plants that have the tiny little itty bitty parts like foxgloves and lavenders and rosemary, I love that stuff. It's tedious, but it turns out looking so fine. I love it.
I love that. I love that so much.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hit me up, definitely.
Yeah, you and
I will trade you info for it.
Conversations. okay, so kind of in that same vein with this idea of kind of the inhabited spiritual world, and I love that you're imbuing the work that you're doing with the actual essences of the plants and with sort of embodying the spirits of them. You also have, through your research, found these really great inroads into seeing the landscape around us as spirit inhabited in a kind of constant background way. It's not that necessarily, like, you know, you have to do this specific ritual on a full moon and go to the woods in the dark of night to find, like, literally blue jays can be messengers of the devil, which if you've ever been dive bombed by a blue jay, you probably thought
absolutely Satan's minions all the way. Oh yeah.
So, like, you know, How, you know, is that something that you're drawing from folklore? Like, how are you seeing this sort of spirit inhabited landscape and the sort of everydayness of it? How do you, you know, reconcile those kind of two things?
Well, like I said, growing up in my family, so especially within the Indigenous American community, animistic religion still plays a huge part. Medicine plays a huge part of everyday life. Growing up, I was taught that there was no separation between the spirits of the living. There was no separation between the soul of a spider or a snake or me. We were all just living different kinds of existence under the Creator, and all of that was equal. And every single spirit in existence has a function and a connection and an inherent quality to it, and a power and a personality. And that was so normalized to me, especially through storytelling. Now, up here in the Northwest, storytelling culture is how you get information about your own people, how you get information about a culture. It's how you learn how the people here grew, saw the world, lived their lives. And one of the stories I grew up with was a story of Blue Jay, the trickster. And in the stories up here, he's kind of a jerk. I mean, he's a trickster, and he's loud and obnoxious. And that was so familiar with to me. And as I started to gather more research, I had been veering into this section of African-American folklore about the color blue, about how hate blue and the blue fire of the devil, all these the importance of the color blue. And it was all coinciding at this time where I was still thinking about the importance of the Blue Jay in the stories that of the land that I live on this coast. And I came across information about the Blue Jay in the Frank C. Brown collection, in the Botkin collection, in the Waylon B. Hand collection, and the Journal of American Folklore. And I was like, wow. So at some point in time, people were like, yeah, on Fridays, Blue Jays go tell the devil what you're doing. And I was like, why? What is the point? What is the function here? And the more I looked into it, the more I kind of understood why there would be that connection. This loud trickster spirit that, you know, can be so bold and brash, this talker. That's his quality. That's his personality, his gift. That's the medicine that this entity brings to the world. I can see why people associate him with being a tattletale to some sort of, you know, entity that delves into punishment or into temptation, like the devil does in a lot of our folklore. I love these kinds of things. I love these everyday superstitions and fears that people have just based on the personality and the actions of an animal. I think it says a lot about how much we try to personify and symbolize the world around us. This world really is inhabited in every regard, spiritually and physically, by so much mystery. And I think I really enjoy exploring how much spirits play a part or have played a part in how we have developed our own cultures, our storytelling, how we have developed our idea of how animal personalities work and who they are to us. I really love that. We're always looking for connections. We're always trying to see ourselves in animals. So we'll see magicianry in the mole. We'll see witchcraft in the toad. We'll see sorcery in the frog, and witchcraft in the rabbit and the snake. And I love that. I love that we're trying so hard to forge a connection. And I love pursuing how much our folklore explores that.
Absolutely. And how much we sort of are defined by our interactions with those things. Like I can define winter by, you know, thinking of the red of a cardinal against a drift of snow, or the coming of spring with a sort of a crowd of robins pecking on the ground. So I very much kind of feel what you're saying there, and that sort of lived animism of the day.
Yes, absolutely.
And you know, even beyond that, like even kind of beyond sort of cosmological constructs that we're dealing with, this idea of kind of spirits all around us. You're also, like, through this kind of everydayness, this everyday experience of magic, you're also kind of pulling up these really, dirt under the nails kind of practices of witchcraft, right? Like you wrote, you mentioned rat letters earlier, which is something I don't think a lot of people know about, but the use of just making sure that you have a little bit of someone's hair if just in case.
Yes.
for better or worse, right?
Yes.
You know, don't, or you know, knowing not to leave your hairbrush out around me is apparently a thing for a lot of people now.
Yep.
so you know, are those, you know, why is it these like little ways, these little customs, why is it superstitions are so good at forming the backbone of these bigger magical structures, do you think?
Because they connect us to our ancestors and to our children. They offer us a chance to look backwards and forwards. It's a connection. That's what we're so desperately reaching for, is we're trying to understand where we came from and we're trying to pass that forward. When we hold on to these little things, these tiny little mundane or seemingly mundane tasks, these little entertaining fortunes and divinations, these little charms we do, these little, you know, things as simple as sweeping up your hair to burn to make sure nobody else does it. Mm-hmm. In many ways, we're just trying to reach back to something simple, to where we came from, to our ancestors. We're trying to touch the same world that they touched, that we are so far removed from, especially in this modern world. I think a lot of witches, especially those who are veering towards folk witchcraft, are trying to reach back to a time that wasn't more simple, but was a lot more alive. You actually had to touch the world around you. It was tangible. You had to hunt your own meat. You had to smell these smells and taste these tastes that were very raw and real, and they weren't packaged in plastic like our modern world is. It's not that it was better or worse as much as it's more about feeling alive, feeling connected to the dead and to your mortality and to your immortality. I think that's really what this is about, is trying to reclaim a bit of the past in an effort to feel like some part of you and your practice will be immortal. It will be passed down by your kids or the people that you teach. Mm-hmm. And I think that's like a desperate love that we have. I love that. I was raised with that. My sister and mother and I, you know, we have very strict instructions for our hair, our salon and barbers. You got to give us our hair back. It's very important that you don't keep our hair. It's, you know, some of these practices are super important. It's always very important that when someone dies, we open a window and we smudge the whole house. You have to drum. You got to drum the house clear. You know, these things were like, it's nothing bad's going to happen to you if you don't, but you really should do it. And part of that just made me feel so connected to my ancestors, to my grandmas and grandpas, my culture. It felt so connecting to do this with my sister and my mom and my aunts and stuff. It made me feel like things that are out of our control, all these things that change so much around us, some things don't change. Some things actually stay. And that little piece is so worth holding on to.
I love that. And I also love the point that you made about, you know, we tend to think of ancestry and ancestral line as linear passing, you know, from, you know, bloodline ancestors or you know, relatives down through children. But you made this really great point about, you know, the people that you teach, or even, you know, you mentioned the hair thing, and it can be this really interesting moment. I had a friend in college who I went with him one time to get a haircut, and he got his haircut, and he you know, asked the barber to gather up his hair and take it with him. And it was that moment where I was like, wait a second, you do this thing too. And it was a moment of lateral connection necessary rather than, vertical passage, right? This is stuff that can go laterally too and pass out beyond you and connect you to the world around you. So you can have ancestry that is, you know, synchronous with you in your own time. You can have ancestry that's teachers in the past or relatives. You can have ancestors to be that are children, but also students that are also, you know, friends of friends of friends. So I really love kind of your structure on that. That's so neat. So
thank you so much.
I can't let us end our discussion without getting into Witch Flight, because that was something I think we both kind of geeked out about each other's writing on Witch Flight.
Oh my God. Can I just say, I died of jealousy. It was so infuriating. I really do wish there was a word for that feeling where you're like, God damn it, you amazing person. I want to be you when I grow up. Why are you doing this to me? Right? Just now.
That's so funny.
I loved it. Your book is going to be so stunning. I am so excited.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm really excited for yours too, because it's covering a lot of the ground that, like, you do things where I'm like, oh, I wish I thought to put that in my book too.
So, ditto. Hard ditto. So,
but with which flight specifically, we both kind of are tackling this idea of which flight as, you know, it tends to be that something that people kind of visualize as witches on broomsticks, you know, maybe flying to Sabbats, maybe flying to orgies. But, you know, I know I have a different perspective on it. What is your perspective? What is the purpose of witch flight? What are witches doing when they're flying out of their houses?
Ooh, I think that serves multiple purposes. Mm-hmm. I would say that flight probably played an allegorical role that further establishes these traditions of belief about what these entities we call witches do, mm-hmm. helps further establish fears and traditions and scares your kids properly into staying in their beds at night or, you know, doing specific things to keep themselves safe. I think it plays an ecstatic role that satisfies this inherent need for freedom that we have. Mm-hmm. I can see why our ancestors made so much folklore surrounding the idea of a witch flying as a fireball or as a bird or on a broom or a butter dasher. I can see why they put so much effort and fear into this. It's freedom. It's pure freedom. It's this motif of a wild woman or man who is free to fly into the night away from all the constraints and the bounds and the bonds. I think it served a really huge role in idealizing that a little bit, which is probably why it became such a popular facet of folklore. I know for me personally, I think it is an exploration of your psyche, of the dreams, the otherworldly, especially, I would say dreams most importantly. When I think of flight, I think of preparing for dream time, for the wisdom and the prophecies that come to us in our sleep. I see it as more of a meditation, personally for me today. But, you know, I really enjoy the folklore about all the flying ointments and the baby fat and all that. That's all so, so much fun. But I think flight really is really more symbolic than people give it credit for. It has a lot to do maybe with our sense of freedom and our desire for freedom, and how we do that can come in so many different ways. We can do it through, you know, these psychoactive substances, or through smokes, or through rituals, meditation, trance, drumming, singing, that kind of. The concept of flight itself, when I think about the old school flight, I do think of witches on brooms and butter mm-hmm. dashers, riding horses that are definitely people.
yes.
You know, I think of all that too, but I think of that as more as like a place that I go in that my spirit goes in my dreams. That's where the nighttime work comes in.
Mm. And that's such an excellent kind of point to make. You mentioned earlier even the idea of like parents telling their children, you know, about Sukiyans or any of the sort of like night hag type witches that might come. And so this is sort of a boogeyman figure to keep them in yes. bed. But that's so interesting, because if you think about it, if they're going to be staying in bed, the idea is that they will then be slipping the fetters of the mortal world and flying off into their own dream worlds. You know, the witch is needed. The witch is a necessary thing to allow for flight for everyone else too. Right. So I just think that's so fascinating as a symbol.
Oh yeah. I love the symbol. I especially love the folklore regarding people who are unwillingly taken on witches' flights or stumble onto a witch's yes. flight, and the witches are sort of like, oh, well, you're here now. Roll with us, homie. And it's pretty awesome. I kind of love that idea. I think a lot of it has to do with these, you know, scaring naughty children, but also fulfilling a fantasy, oh, yes. a deep-seated freedom fantasy we all have to go flying.
Oh, yes. And there's always the catch-22 of it where they're, you know, like, oh, yeah, you can come and, you know, raid the local landlord's cellar with us and drink all the wine, and we'll just leave you there to take the blame in the morning.
So. Absolutely. I love that. I love that witches always have these little ironic twists, you know? Mm-hmm. I like that a lot. One of the funnest parts.
I think being a witch means that you are inherently a good riddle master, that you're able yes. to understand everything as a potential riddle and make everything into a potential riddle. So I love it. Okay. So you've got a book coming out late 2020, early 2021.
Yes.
You know, what should people be expecting from that? What are they going to get out of your book?
I think people should expect some great information on how similar our cultural practices are here in the New World, how much our folk magic, the entire history of it, has been shaped by multiple cultures, in some ways appropriating from one another, thieving from one another, being inclusive, sharing. There's so many different dimensions to how African Americans, European Americans, Native Americans exchanged folk information, folk magic, and traditional medicine, that we have so much to celebrate in what is common between us than all the things that we highlight as different, especially in a world that is so politically polarized right now. And especially during a time where the conversation about race, especially multiculturality and multiracialism, is so important. I wanted to lend my voice to that. I don't see a lot of people out there who look like me talking about what it's like to have grown up between all these cultures, to have touchstones from each and every one of these cultures that make up the broader America, and how that magic has deeply influenced everything we think of when we think of witches, when we think of Halloween, when we think of flying on broomsticks. This is an effort from cultures all over the world. And I wanted to highlight that. People can learn more about it by following Moon Books Publishing, from John Hunt's publishing, actually, but Moon Books, you want to follow them. They're going to have a lot more information about the book coming out. You know, in the future, I'm hoping to write some more books, about practical guides to folk charms, for everyday occasions. I really want to write a book about silly folk charms. I really do just want to go through my litany of resources of the most ridiculous charms I could possibly find and just put all those together. Because I think someone should probably highlight how much silly, crazy nonsense really is out there and how fun it is. I would love to do one like that, just a total gag book. So that's what I'm working on. Other than that, I'm still working on statues, still taking commissions, and, you know, hoping for the best.
Excellent. I mean, it sounds like you're staying plenty busy, and I'm so excited. I'm glad that you managed to put out as much as you do with your website as well. If people don't know, they should definitely be following your website, because you are producing a ton of great resources, on North American folk magic. So, they can find you at viahedera.com, www.viahedera.com. And then you're also somewhat active on social media as well, right?
Yes, on Instagram and Facebook, you can find me as Via Hedera. I love to talk to people. I love to conversate. If you're in the Seattle area, I love to meet up. Please feel free to contact me about some of the research, or if you have any questions about some of the things you've seen on my website. I love discussing folklore and hearing everyone's points of view.
Excellent. Well, I am so, so thrilled that you decided to come on the show, and I feel like we could sit here and talk for hours over folk magic and find all kinds of cool stuff. So I really appreciate you coming on to chat with us about your perspective and the work that you're doing. So Via Hedera, thank you so much for coming to New World Witchery.
Thank you so much, Corey. It has been a blast. It's been a long time coming, and I look forward to both of our books out there in the world.
Absolutely. Yes. I cannot wait.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Have a great night.
You too.
Our immense and special thanks to Via Hedera for coming on to talk to us. We hope that you'll check out her website and watch for her book later this year or early next year when it hits bookshelves. If you'd like to share your thoughts on this episode or any other episode with us, you can email us at compassandkey@gmail.com, or you can find us on the internet at newworldwitchery.com. Feel free to follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You can follow us on Instagram as well, or on our YouTube channel. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can do that at our hotline, which is 442-999-4824. That's 442-99-WITCH, if that helps. We really appreciate your support. If you'd like to show a little extra support, you can do so by dropping by our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/newworldwitchery, where you can put a dollar a month or whatever you can afford into our pointy witchy hat and help us find new spells, new sorts of magic to work. We definitely appreciate any support you can give us that way. And if that's not your speed, if that's not something that you can do, we totally get that. We highly appreciate you just sticking around to listen. And if you like what you hear, please feel free to share this around with other people. Spreading the word is kind of how people find out about us, so that's super helpful. Leaving reviews, also great. If you like this show and you also happen to like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, shameless plug for Myth Taken, a Buffy the Vampire Slayer podcast, which Lane and I do on a bi-weekly basis. And you can hear all about our thoughts on various Buffy episodes and kind of the bigger Buffyverse. You can also support us if you like by going through the Audible trial program. If you don't know what Audible is, it is the world's largest provider of audiobooks. So you can get around 200,000 different titles. You can try out a free version of Audible by going to audibletrial.com/newworldwitchery. You get to download a free book. You can keep the book even if you choose not to continue your subscription. And if you do continue to choose your subscription, that helps support us and, you know, get some awesome books. There's going to be some really good ones on there for you if you like folk magic and North American history and things like that, including possibly, possibly a book by me at some point and possibly a book by Via Hedera. So, again, thank you so much for listening. We hope that you've enjoyed this episode. I know I did. So thank you for being a part of it. And as always, thanks for listening. Be well. New World Witchery is a production of New World Witchery Podcasts and is released under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. The title and closing music for this episode is Woman Blues by Paul F. Guernos, licensed from AudioSocket.